battery's good to go. Okay, so let me briefly describe Christian life in the late Middle Ages. And when we think of Catholicism, in some sense, this is our idea of Catholicism. All right, and it's a fairly accurate view of Catholicism, I think, but it's the Catholicism of the Middle Ages. Okay, Catholicism in the Middle Ages was dominated by the idea of purgatory. I mean, most people's idea of our principal job in this life was to find a way either for us to get around purgatory or for our loved ones to get around purgatory. And I've done a lot of reading, I've read a lot of sources, and these are people just talking about their life and then people talking about this period, and I get the sense that this was the main thing going on in Catholic Christianity. Almost everything you hear people talking about what they did related to how I'm going to get myself or somebody else out of purgatory. Seemed that way. Confession became obligatory, as I said. Now, this created some big problems. Because who was alone with who? Priests were alone with beautiful, young, unmarried women. And the number of scandals that came out of this was huge. So they developed an entire theology of how to do a confession and all these safeguards, which improved the situation. But you know the whole thing with the box, with the little thing there? That's the result of what they had to do. So because they weren't having these little interviews in a room, that stopped. And that was a smart idea. Of course, they should have just had confession be to one another. So penance, masses. The saying of masses, it's hard to even imagine this whole idea. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of priests who spent all day every day simply saying masses. And they would say masses in which nobody was there. So what you could do is you could purchase 1,000 masses. You could literally purchase 1,000 masses. And there were priests who would stay in their monasteries, wherever they were, and just go, probably say it as fast as they could, blah, blah, blah. And then, okay, all right, now let's do it again. And so people in their will would leave money, because what they want to do is they want to get released from purgatory. And the bottom line is, the richer you are, the faster you're out of purgatory. This is, wow, I mean, oh my goodness. So, a countless number of masses being said, in which the only person present at the mass was the priest. Not even the person the mass was being said for, because often they were dead already. And there are many, copies of wills that show this is exactly what was happening. Confession, pilgrimages, crusades, indulgences. The building of chapels, one of the favorite ways to have an indulgence was to build a chapel. Yeah?
I have a question. I've been to a Catholic funeral recently, and what they'll do is they'll have the priest say the name of the person in the family and a prayer for. Is that an indulgence today? Would that be?
No, that's a mass. An indulgence would be...
But this is like part of like the general mass they're having anyway, and then there's a section where they say, and for the reason deceased... So-and-so.
But did somebody pay something? Or
I don't know. I was
probably
sure
not.
Okay.
An indulgence would be not necessarily money. An indulgence, so technically, a pilgrimage could be an indulgence. Sure. Technically, a crusade could be an indulgence, or going on a mission could be an indulgence. So an indulgence is essentially anything you give or do to purchase time out of purgatory. That's what an indulgence is. And the building of chapels was how really, really, really rich people would attain salvation. And the building of chapels is how sort of moderately rich people. And one of the things that the gatherings of Christians, like I said, my brain's going to stuff, did not work so well. Those things that they had. No. The Yeah, those things, you know. It was a long time ago, wasn't it? When I was talking about the humiliati. Yes, yes, these confraternities. One of the things these confraternities would do was build chapels. So if you go into all these cathedrals, you see all these chapels. What are the chapels for? Those were money that were donated. And people could go in and worship. And you'll see a lot of chapels have a lock on there, right?
Yeah.
Why? Because that chapel is an indulgence for this person and these people. So the only people who can go in there are those people. And a lot of the chapels would be outside, built outside the church rather than in the sacristy. Yeah.
Will there be some kind of recognition for the person that it was created for?
Of course.
Or recognized for?
Yes, of course. But again, the main purpose is to achieve an indulgence, to get escape for yourself or for others from purgatory. And priests would preach these long sermons. Just imagine your uncles and your aunts, they're crying out to you in purgatory, give us some money. Don't you care about their souls? This was what Christianity was like. Yeah.
As far as like what they said for each person, like whether that's a Hail Mary or a chapel building, or was there like a, was it totally up to the priest just what he felt like
yes.
to say? Was there a list of, okay, if you lie,
what was bound on earth by the priest is bound in heaven.
So they could just make it whatever they wanted
yep.
for the person.
But they had books. They had books saying for this, that, you know, they had it's kind of like, you know, a judge has certain sentence guidelines. They had that kind of stuff.
Is that
totally.
Published or?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's yes. Those things were read a lot more than the Bible. I'll tell you right now. Absolutely. Are you kidding? Yes. All right. Good. Oh, this is when the penitentes. The penitentes are a thing that started like in the 12th or 13th century. So this is, at first, only monks did this. So they'll whack, you know, whack. And wearing clothes with barbs in them, so you get constant injuries. All right? And basically purposely causing pain all the time. Wearing underwear with thorns in them. Or, you know, nailing yourself to a cross. Or, but this became a lay thing. At first, this was only in monasteries. But by the 13th century, we had processions of thousands. It was always men for some reason, you know, and whipping themselves or whipping the other person in front of you. And this penitentes, which, by the way, in Philippines, this is actually a thing even now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did doing that like take time off of your purgatory? Is that why they did that?
Yeah, but now you're trying to kind of get rid of stuff now. Generally, purgatory, you know, like the saying of Hail Marys is kind of getting rid of sins now.
Right.
Our fathers, and that's for, you know, sins now. But just in case you haven't done enough, then I don't think they were doing this for after they died. I don't even think they were doing this for their relatives. I think they were doing this for themselves. Has anybody seen the movie The Mission? That is a great movie, and it's about these monks in Brazil. And this one guy was this horrible slave person who sold slaves, and he repented, and so he drags this huge net full of all the former swords and shields and stuff, and he drags them. I mean, if you want to get just an emotional feel for the idea of what this is like. See the movie The Mission. Anybody over 50 knows this movie, and it is a total classic. Yeah. Yeah, but what's better than that? And by the way, it's a truly inspiring movie, by the way. It is very inspiring. It's kind of creepy, but it's also very, very inspiring. Okay, good. So I don't have time to go into the Babylonian captivity. Let's just say it got bad. All right. So basically, The papacy became a football. So the king of France is in opposition to the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, who's in opposition to Naples. So these guys want the papacy. All right, these guys want the papacy. These guys want the papacy. So what happened is you have like three or four factions. So these guys stole, they stole the papacy. And they moved it to Avignon. And this is in the 14th century. And that's called the Babylonian captivity of the church. You know how the Babylonian captivity of the Jews? So for what, about 70 years, the popes were there in Avignon. And like if they had 60 cardinals, like 58 of them were French. All right, there are no Italian cardinals. By the way, I didn't mention the creation of the system of the cardinals. Before the cardinals, which I believe is 12th century, it might be off by a century, it's in the notes. Before the cardinals, the emperor, the head of the Holy Roman Empire, basically picked the pope. But the pope says, the guys I own, the cardinals, they called them cardinals because they wore those red clothing, that they would pick the pope. So basically, the pope's best buddies, almost all of whom were Italian living, you know, from Rome, they would pick the next pope. Which was better, having the emperor or this cardinals, I don't know. So the bottom line is you have the people saying, no, Rome, obviously Rome, said Rome, no, Avignon, Scotland was always an ally of France, never an ally of England. Are you kidding? Your neighbor is your worst enemy kind of thing. And so this is just a terrible stain on Catholicism.
John, what's the orange right there?
Those were people that they kind of... See, these guys controlled things because they went from one side to the other. So if these guys with those guys goes with those guys, then those guys win. If these guys go with these guys win. So the best person to be is that one right there. You know, because they would generally decide. These guys did not change. All right, you got it? So it's all about politics, right? The papacy is all about the politics. Now, there were usually two popes, and occasionally there were even three popes. Even three popes. And each pope would excommunicate the other pope. Oh, goodness gracious. All right. So now we're going to get back to good news. Let's talk about John Wycliffe. Okay. All right. So we have two semi-successful attempts at Reformation. All right. And that is the work of John Huss in England, and the John Wycliffe, rather, in England, and the work of John Huss in Bohemia. Okay. John Wycliffe was an Oxford Don. In other words, he was just a professor. He's a professor of theology at Oxford. His principal role throughout his life was as an educator. He was not a priest, but he was dragged into the controversies of his day. His conversion event was not falling off a horse because of a lightning strike. It was not seeing a poor man and giving him his clothes. His conversion event was a political one rather than a religious one. The year is 1365. Wycliffe is, he's about 40 years old. He's been a professor for like 15 or 20 years. He was just your average professor at Oxford for many years. His conversion came, you know, as in his Middle Ages. Anyway, Pope Urban demanded a tribute from King Edward III. Now, for many, many years, England had been paying tribute to Rome. And, you know, in order to support the military exploits of Rome. And by the way, if you go back, you can see England was officially on the Rome side, not on the France side. Okay, got it? But the Pope says you need to pay this indulgence. And the king says, no, we're not going to pay indulgences. And Wycliffe was called to write the response to the Pope. And so Wycliffe became the hero of England because here's this guy, this English Don, who's saying, don't tread on me, Mr. Pope. The money we collect here is going to stay here. Wycliffe, in his thing that he wrote to the Pope, he said that roughly one-third of the entire country of England is already owned by the papacy. And to Wycliffe, the worst thing about Catholicism was those Franciscans and those Dominicans. And these monks and these friars were just the worst possible thing. He didn't see them as protecting God at all, but as protecting Rome. But guess what? That's what they did. Because the Franciscans and the Dominicans, like unlike other monks, they were totally under Rome. They weren't under the bishops. The bishops were local. All right? So he published on the truth of the Holy Scriptures in 1378. By then, he's already 54 years old. This is, what, 13 years after this political event? Now he's becoming a reformer. Okay? And in this book, he said the Bible is the sole rule of faith. All right, I'm going to read this quote. Already a third and more of England is in the hands of the Pope. There cannot be two temporal sovereigns in one country. Either Edward is king or Urban is king. The English are saying, yes! And he was very, very popular. Very popular. He was more popular in England than the King of England was. Anyway, so in this thing he said, the Bible is the sole rule of faith. He said the Bible has to be in the vernacular. Unfortunately, the vernacular then was not English. It was Latin from his perspective. I'm sorry, it was in English, but he translated from Latin. So he produced the first English Bible. Now, unfortunately, his translation was made not from the Greek or the Hebrew, but from the Latin. He did not know Greek or Hebrew, as far as I know. And this is before the printing press. So it's not like people were reading his translation, but for the first time, the Bible became available in English. All right, and for that alone, he deserves to be a hero of the faith for sure. He said, Jesus is the head of the church, not the Pope. That's not going to make very many friends in Rome. He said the Lord's Supper is only a reminder, not a reenactment. To him, the greatest enemy of Christianity was the friars. And he oversaw the translation, which was completed by 1382. Like all of these Reformation movements, they all said, we need to give preaching to the common people. Take it away from a clergy, that the laity need to preach righteousness. All right, that seems like a good idea, doesn't it? Called before the bishops to renounce, his renunciation of transubstantiation, his response is, the truth shall prevail. Now, the Catholic Church tried to arrest him, and they would bring him in for public trial. And every time they did, huge crowds would surround the building. It's like, if we arrest this guy, if we kill him and put him in jail, we're going to be the next one to be killed. He was very, very popular. And so the Roman authorities, no matter what they did, they just couldn't kill this guy. They just couldn't get away with it. He called the Pope the Antichrist. Ouch. All right, now we're in trouble. Big trouble. His followers became known as Lollards. Also, they were called Roundheads. All right. They were declared heretics in 1401, but look when he died. The guy died in his, bed. They didn't kill him. It is amazing. It's absolutely amazing that he wasn't killed.
John, what's the name Lollards mean?
It means the followers of Wycliffeism. I don't know why they're called... It probably says in my book why they were called Lollards. I just happen to forget. All right? I can't remember. Here's what Courtenay, the Archbishop of Canterbury, said about Wycliffe. He said, if we permit this heretic to appeal continually to the passions of the people, our destruction is inevitable. We must silence these Lollards. How prophetic is that? How pathetic is that? But how prophetic is that? He says, if we let these people talk, we're going to be kicked out of England. Oh, guess what eventually happened? They got kicked out of England. Yeah.
I found out that Lollard was a derogatory nickname.
Of course.
Those academic background. So,
these dummies, these idiots, given that that Wycliffe was one of the greatest scholars of his age, is kind of ironic that they would say that. Yeah, these idiots. These hillbillies, these country hicks or whatever. Yeah. He died of natural causes, but in 1401, his group was denounced as heretics, and you can imagine the martyrdoms added up very, very quickly. Fox's Books of Martyrs includes many of the Lollards who were killed. All right, and 1415 at the Council of Constance, he was posthumously excommunicated. And his remains were dug up, burned, and thrown into the river. Ha ha, on you, okay? But that was almost 30 years after he died. In fact, it was 31 years after he died.
There wasn't really much left at that point.
All right, the Lollards continued without Wycliffe. Their numbers stopped growing, and they became a relatively small. By the time the Reformation came to England, there was a small remnant of Lollards still left around, but basically they had to start kind of over again. Okay, John Huss, the Bohemian equivalent of John Wycliffe. He was highly influenced by Wycliffe. He was slightly less radical than Wycliffe. And his Reformation was somewhat gradual. Okay. He was from Prague. He was an outstanding scholar. He became the Dean of Philosophy at the University of Prague, which meant, you know, he's like top professor there. In 1401, at that time, he was, 35 years old. So he was just—he was the greatest scholar at the University of Prague. There, Bohemia was already a center of radical ideas and of Reformation, kind of like Switzerland. Bohemia would be Czechoslovakia today, Prague. Okay, in 1402, he gained the pulpit there in Bethlehem, with the Chapel of Bethlehem, and there he began to preach in Bohemian instead of in Latin, all right? Because he believed that unless people understand what I'm saying, why am I bothering to say it? Good point. And it was from this pulpit that he announced his Reformation. He was a bit less radical than Wycliffe. He did not completely, utterly reject purgatory. He was against indulgences to be paid for warfare, but he wasn't against indulgences altogether. Now, we'll see later on, he did oppose a particular indulgence, said they can't come here, which got him excommunicated, but he was not in principle against all indulgences, and not even all sacraments. He didn't even reject transubstantiation. So, he was clearly a little bit less radical than Wycliffe. However, the reason he was pronounced a heretic is he was accused of being a Wycliffeite. The fact is, at some point it mentions here in the year, yes, beginning in 1411, he actually read some of Wycliffe's statements translated into Bohemian. At that point, his fate was sealed. Because in 1401, the writings of Wycliffe had been called heretical. So that's not a good thing. He restored the cup to the Lord's Supper. What do you mean? Well, for I don't know, 800 years, I'm not sure. Nobody had been taking the cup. So the Lord's Supper was the bread only. Did you know that? Catholics didn't take the wine, they only took the bread. Because that, you know, the blood of Jesus, if you let people touch, they're going to spill it. Spilling the blood, how, as if priests never spilled it. So for centuries, I don't know when it started, I could do the research. But for centuries and centuries, the common person had only had the bread. He said, excuse me, there's the Bible. We need to give him the bread and the cup. All right? And so he did that. That's probably not going to make too many friends in Rome. Okay. He had the political support of the Bohemian king. You know the song, Good King Wenceslas looked out. That's the king that supported John Huss. So I guess he's a good king because, you know, that's the Protestant anthem. And Good King Wenceslas is the one who let John Huss preach there in Prague. So he's a pretty good king. All right. Excommunicated in 1411. He didn't absolutely reject indulgences, but he said they certainly cannot be used for war. So here's what he said. I am ready with all my heart to obey the apostolic mandates. Was he trying to leave the Catholic Church? No. Neither was Luther, by the way. All right. Zwingli was, Calvin definitely was, but Huss had no intention of leaving the Catholic Church. By the way, neither did Wycliffe. They were not trying to start another church. They were trying to reform. Anyway, but I call apostolic mandates the doctrines of the apostles of Christ. And so far as the papal mandates agree with these, so far will I obey them, most willingly. But if I see anything at variance with the word of God, I shall not obey, even though the stake were staring me in the face. O-M-G. Because guess what was staring him in the face? 4 years later, burned at the stake. Yeah. He was forced into exile. And by the way, the king there said we should not have read Wycliffe, and they burned Wycliffe's documents. They kind of semi backed off. They didn't totally back off. They kind of partially supported Hus, partially didn't. He did come back to Prague and begin preaching again. He went into a brief exile during which he wrote the church. Now, unlike Augustine or Calvin or Luther, he did not write a lot of stuff. But he did write this thing, The Church, in which, at this point, after 1411, he's kind of like, all right, never mind. This is going to be a reformation. And he almost caught up with Wycliffe. So in his book, he said he believed in the priesthood of all believers. He said the Bible is the only authority. Only God can forgive sin. Idols, saints, all that stuff should not be done. So they said, please come to the Council of Constance to have a discussion about these so you can present your ideas to us. He said, I'm not going there. You're going to kill me. They said, we swear, we promise. And the king of Hungary promised safe passage. And so he went there. And for the first 3 months, the Council of Constance lasted for like 3 or 4 years. For the first 3 months or so, he's just kind of walking around having discussions. But at some point, he was arrested, put into a Dominican dungeon. What a surprise. He was called before the kings and bishops. Here's what he said. I, John Hus, in hope a priest of Jesus Christ, fearing to offend God and fearing to fall into perjury, do hereby profess my unwillingness to abjure all or any of the articles produced against me by false witnesses. And if it were possible that my voice could now reach the whole world, as at the day of judgment every lie and every sin that I have committed will be made manifest, then would I gladly abjure before all the world every falsehood and error which I either have thought or said or actually said. However, he's not going to take back what he said. He was condemned and burned at the stake, July 6, 1415. The executioners ordered the ground on which his ashes fell to be dug up, thrown into the Rhine River, which the Constance is on the Rhine, and so no one could carry home relics of their martyred leaders, which he wouldn't have wanted them to do anyway, right? Did Hussism die? No, it lived. So, I mean, to some extent, Wycliffe's movement didn't completely die, but it became almost completely ineffective. So there were people kind of waiting for another leader to come back. But Hussitism did not disappear, not at all, actually. But unfortunately, it split into two groups. One were called the Ultraquists. The Ultraquists said, you know what? Really, all we really need to do is reestablish the Lord's Supper with the wine and the bread. If you do that, if you'll compromise and at least let us observe the Lord's Supper with both kinds, then we're going to come back into the Catholic Church. But of course, the Pope was not going to bend on that. But anyway, so they published the Articles of Prague, the right of preaching the Scripture without hindrance, Eucharist in both kinds. Clergy loses all their property, so the church is going to lose all its property in Bohemia, which they're not too excited about that. And mortal sins would be punished by God, not by some kind of penance. So it was a very mild set of things that they insisted, but of course the Catholic Church turned them down. So the Ultraquists, and then there were the Taborites. You can read my book about why they're called Taborites. So basically, the Hussites were the conservative wing who, you know, would agree with about half of what John Hus said, but said, if we have just half, that's enough, we'll go back into the Catholic Church. And then the Taborites, who were like a true Reformation. And I believe the Taborites represented John Hus's spirit more accurately. They produced a set of demands which went slightly beyond John Hus, but not much. So these Taborites were a true restorationist group. Yeah. Even more than the Lollards. But here's a problem that always happens with restorations, is division. I'm just telling you, one of the chief problems with any restoration is division. Because if you're trying to restore Christianity, what does that mean? That is a really good question. If you're going to restore, what are you going to restore? Which are the necessary things? We as a fellowship have to decide what's necessary. And we better make sure the things that are necessary are truly necessary. And I'm sure that not everything we say is necessary, is indeed necessary. And I'm sure some of the things that are not necessary, we're necessarily not everything that is necessary are we even saying is necessary. By the way, I'm purposely being vague, but I'm just saying it's a never-ending story. Your generation is going to have to go back at this again. Again, you know, otherwise you're going to have to leave our movement and find a better movement, one or the other. You know what I'm saying? It's not simple. It's not easy. So the bottom line is the Taborites fractioned into a group that were basically millennialists, into a group that were basically communists, into other groups that were fairly level-headed, that you or I might have said, yes, that's pretty awesome. That, yes, pretty awesome group eventually became basically a Hussite movement that became the Brethren Church. The Brethren Church is a recognizably Christian kind of church. It's a restorationist church. By the way, the Brethren still exist. I was in England. I was teaching at one of the regions there in London, and we were meeting in a Brethren church. I mean, this is a John Huss church in England, even today. All right, so that's kind of interesting. All right, so here's a question on page 58. By the way, I'm only a page and a half done from being done. We're doing great. We're going to finish by 4:30, okay? Don't be too happy about that. No, just kidding. All right. So, are we a reformation or are we a restoration? Those are two different things. All right, and I don't have the right answer, but I think that there's a difference in philosophy between reforming and restoring. All right, the early leaders of the restoration movement did not see themselves as a restoration movement. They saw themselves as a reformation movement. I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm just talking here. I'm telling you what happened. I think it's useful to know what happened. All right. So anyway, at the Council of Constance, which lasted for like 4 years, in 1415, like about a year into the conference, they executed John Huss. 2 years later, the conference is still going on. The council is still going on. They began a crusade against the Bohemians. They launched successive waves of attack in 1420, 1421, 1422, 1427, 1431. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people killed in this brutal war, but they couldn't win. The bottom line, those Hussites were tough. And for 20 years, the Utraquists and the Taborites said, we may disagree, but we are going to form a united front. We are not going to give in to these guys. It was a brutal war fought to a standstill, kind of like Afghanistan for the last, 15 years, kind of like that kind of sort of thing. Finally, though, Rome offered a bribe to the Utraquists. They say, hey, if you'll come onto our side, we're going to give you this, this, and this. So they created essentially an Utraquist church, basically a separate Czechoslovakian church. So not the Roman Catholic Church, the Bohemian Catholic Church, the Utraquist Church, at which, remember those four articles from the last page? Those four articles, they said, you can have that. So they said, great. So they turned their tail, became traitors to the Taborites, which, you know, if you've been in a war for the last 20 years, you might have wanted to do as well. Peace at any price? No, peace at this price. They got something out of it. once that happened, the Bohemian movement was crushed. All right? And there is no, you know, when they say somebody's Bohemian, what do they mean by that?
Currently or?
Yeah. Bohemian, yeah.
So it means you're some kind of an artist.
Yeah.
Chooses to let go of wealth and live a poor life.
Yeah. And but see, the Bohemians lost their place. There was no Bohemia. This crusade wiped Bohemia off the map. It literally. I mean, look at maps of Europe. Before this, there's Bohemia. And it literally wiped Bohemia off the map. And the Bohemian language even virtually ceased to exist. That's how brutal this suppression was of our brothers and sisters was. So we need to be thankful and proud of what these brothers and sisters did. Now, they weren't all killed. They existed in small groups. The brethrens, at the time of Luther's Reformation, there are estimates that there were 400 brethren churches in Germany and Poland and what we call Czechoslovakia today, Bohemia. And their estimates as many as 200,000. That's a lot of Hussites. And they produced the first hymnal in any language other than Latin. And hymnals were a big thing in Protestant churches. So you could say the Reformation started with John Huss, and we wouldn't be wrong. You could say that. You could say it started with Wycliffe. You wouldn't be wrong. Most people say 1517. I'd say the clearest moment to begin the Reformation would be 1517. But here we have, and by the way, does it mention the 30-Year War? During the 30-Year War, which is in the 1600s, when the Catholics and the Protestants, it's terrible, it's one of the worst wars. Basically, World War I was really World War II, the predecessor of which was the 30 Years' War. And during that time, the Brethrens basically ceased to exist. But after the 30 Years' War, they kind of reconstituted themselves as the Moravian Church. And today, there are more Moravians. And we'll learn about the Moravian Church in February. But the Moravian Church had more, was an inspiration. When Alexander Campbell came from Scotland to America, on his voyage were Moravians. And Moravians were the principal evangelists, the principal missionaries in the world in the 1600s and 1700s were the Moravians, especially the 1700s. So the Moravian Church is another remnant church of John Huss's movement. Okay? Joan of Arc, she's awesome. Don't have time for her. Brigida of Sweden, Catherine of Siena. I keep skipping these women who, I'm telling you, this is not a minor thing. I'm not just putting this in here because we have a few women because it's politically correct. That's not, no. I'm telling you, Catherine of Siena was almost as influential as, you know, some of these other great people. They were always in monasteries. What Brigitte and Catherine and Teresa of Avila all have in common, they all had visions. They were all visionaries. They all had essentially were prophetesses, if you will. They were all into mysticism. And the fact that they live lives separate from men is the only reason, really, that they're able to do what they did. That other one, I said her name about 30 seconds ago. No, the one from before. The one I skipped to is probably more even than it. Oh, well, yeah, but the other one. Anyway,
Eloise.
Never mind. Anyway, these women were scientists, poets, artists. They were polymaths. Kings, bishops, popes hesitated to go against what these women would say because they were considered like the height of what is awesome about Christianity. All right, Joan of Arc, she too had a vision at 13 years of age. She fought in men's clothing and led the troops and inspired them. I don't know. It's kind of weird. She fought against the British with the French. Who's right on that one? I don't know. captured and executed for wearing men's clothes. She was executed because she wore men's clothes, for being a cross-dresser. Okay? So I apologize both to the men and to the women, that I'm not giving sufficient coverage. I believe my book does do justice to these women. I believe it does. I hope it does. So, guys, you read about them too and make sure you pay attention, all right? Because they were beautiful voices. And, you know, none of these women did any of this bad stuff. None of them ever did any of this bad stuff. None of them did any of the bad stuff. All the bad stuff was due to the men. That's for sure. All right, anyway. So there's John Huss being burned at the stake, 1415. Our last little episode here, all right, kind of ends the medieval period, and it's our last chapter before the Reformation, is the fall of Byzantium. Kind of sad. Remember, one of the biggest blows to Byzantium, well, first of all, there's Islam, and the caliphate took, you know, probably over half. About half, probably over half of the entire Byzantine Empire was conquered by the Muslims. That was the caliphate. All right. But then the Turks came. You've heard of the Ottomans. The Ottoman Empire was a Turkish empire. It crossed over into Europe in 1387. The Turks took Thessalonica, which is right here. And they got a foothold in what we call Europe today. All right. Serbia fell to the Turks in 1389. Serbia is over here. Okay. In 1394, Pope Boniface IX called for a crusade against the Turks. And the response was lukewarm. But by 1394, remember that hill that I had? Remember this hill? 1394 is over there. So when popes call for a crusade in 1394, this is when the conciliar movement is taking hold, the Council of Constance, the pendulum switching more towards the bishops away from the pope somewhat, besides with the Babylonian captivity where there's two or three different popes. I mean, so the power of the papacy is much weaker. Nevertheless, Pope Boniface IX called for a crusade against the Turks, and a relatively small army did form, made of largely Bohemians and Polish Germans, and they did go and fight against the Ottomans, but they were the army was completely destroyed and defeated, and that was the last crusade. That's not a very good ending to the crusades. All right. Anyway, at that point, as you can see from the map, Constantinople was surrounded. They did have a small state here in, you know, where Sparta would be there, kind of that part of Greece. Okay, 1439, this is interesting. For just like a year or two, Constantinople and Rome came together again. Now, in order to do that, Constantinople had to totally concede to everything. Basically, they had to, for all practical purposes, say, we're under you, Pope. Not quite, but it's pretty darn close. And why? Because basically they're saying, yeah, I'll send you troops if you basically submit to me. Because Byzantium was desperate. Desperate. Anything. Please come help us. Don't come here. Come there and attack him from there or there. And so basically the Pope said, yeah, we'll do that. But you have to give up include the Filioque and all this sort of stuff, everything that they hated. But basically the Patriarch in Constantinople said, okay, we'll do it. So for a couple of years, you know that final division of 1054, it was undone for, 300-something years later, undone for a couple of years. But then they took that to Kiev, and by this time the principal power of Orthodoxy was definitely not in Constantinople. It was in Kiev. It would be Ukraine today. It was Russia then, and basically they killed the guys. I mean, there's no way. There is no way We're going to accept this compromise. So basically, they refused it. And so the reunion ended. This produced an autocephalous, see that big word there in the notes, Russian Orthodox Church. And Orthodoxy broke down into autocephalous churches. In other words, self-headed church. So eventually there was a Serbian Catholic Church. There was a Serbian Orthodox Church, a Russian Orthodox Church, a Syrian Orthodox Church. They each had their own liturgy, which was almost identical to the liturgy of, say, Basil or of Chrysostom, except translated into their native language. And so Orthodoxy was more united in some ways than Catholicism, but less united in other ways. So at this point, the Russian Orthodox Church gained its autocephalous state. Not a big deal to us, honestly, but it is kind of important, I guess, in church history. All right, and finally, Byzantium fell in 1453. So the last bastion against Islam in the East fell. Now, politically, this was a pretty small thing, because so what? I mean, really, it was just a city with few square miles outside the walls and this tiny enclave, right? But the symbolic meaning of the falling of Constantinople was huge, because basically this bastion, which had held out for 1,000 years, remember Daniel prophesied, you know, in Daniel chapter 2, that the fourth kingdom will be a divided kingdom, East and West Rome. One will be brittle, the other will be strong. The brittle one was Western Rome, which fell almost immediately after Rome divided. But it said, you know, the other half will be endure. And that is Byzantium, which endured for 1,000 years. All right, as prophesied by Daniel. So the symbolism here is large, because this means that our class for this week can end, because we've basically reached the end of the 15th century. The next thing we're going to be is in the 16th century, and that's going to be our next class, in which we're going to cover the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, the Radical Reformation, the Second Reformation, the formation of Evangelicalism, the First Great Awakening, the Second Great Awakening, Mormonism, Seventh-day Adventism, Pentecostalism. So we got a lot of stuff to cover, but that'll be a couple months, like 2.5 months from now. So thank you for hanging out. I'm glad my voice sort of held out. And you got half an hour free. The reason, the excuse is I can't talk anymore. It's a pretty good excuse. Plus my notes ran out, but thank you, everybody. So that's going to get to Greg somehow?
Yeah, I'm going to take care of that. Dropping off one of the memories.
Good. Isn't he, hasn't he left already?
Yeah, but I think they'll hold on to it until he's back in town.
Oh,
yeah.
Maybe he has another one or something. The problem is his little breathing thing is. Everything else, who cares, but that breathing thing is.
Yeah,
it's kind of important. Yeah, oh, whatever's in that cough is not good. I was healthy when I came here. Yeah, too much work. Running last night turned out to probably be a mistake. Why? My wife told me to take it easy. You're going to get sick, because my wife is very sick right now. Should have listened.
Famous last words.
Yeah.
Is the pace that you're going through the Church of Three like slow for you, fast for you, or you pour it in? Because I've seen.
If you gave me more time, I would take more time.